Our main speaker for this morning is Todd L. from Laguna Hills, California, of the Bellflower Big Book Group. Todd.
Good job. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was nice. Good morning, everyone. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Todd. And it's by God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, and strong sponsorship. I've been clean and sober since April 29th, 1983. And for that, I'm forever grateful. Thank you, Bob, and the committee for inviting me to come up. I want my apologies for not being here all weekend. A class AA brother of mine of 43 years passed away shortly last month, and they had a memorial for him where 700 people showed up, and I was asked to share last night. And I felt it was an honor and a privilege to be there, and I let the committee know as well if they needed to get another speaker for this morning, and they said, nope, we still want you. And so at 7 o'clock, I jumped in the truck and came on up. So here I am, half awake. that's Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group's the Bellflower Big Book Group, which you just heard. We have 300 people there on Monday night if you're ever in the area. Nobody lives in Bellflower, but but everybody comes from faraway places to come to our meeting, and it's always packed with 300 people, and there's still 100 people on Zoom, and you get greeted by 75 people. That's where we put the newcomers so they can learn people's names, and literally, there's 75 people in our greeting line, and it's something nobody goes in that meeting without getting a handshake, at least a hello or goodbye, and I'm grateful. That's my AA address, if you're wondering. That's where the founder of our group started that meeting. He was 64 years sober and 93 years old when he passed away a few months ago. And he was my sponsor for over 30 years. And, he'll always be in my heart. You know, and the way you love somebody is you carry the message. And so I'm grateful to be here on a Sunday morning. And I believe all meetings are spiritual, but I know it's on a Sunday morning, and it's has some meaning, and I'm going to share my story in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now, in a general way, and I'll do my best, I'll do my best with 42 years of, sobriety. I have some experiences, and I've definitely seen a lot go on in Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in Torrance, South Bay area. My family... I have two younger sisters. They're 4 and 5 years younger than me. They were snitches, and still shady to this day. They're 4 and 5 years younger than me, so we're in our 50s. And one almost died from alcoholism, and I saw cirrhosis of the liver where she was in the hospital, and I don't know how she walked out of there, but she did, and she hasn't had a drink since, but it's a dry recovery, and I'm just her big brother. I'll always be their big brother, and I love them no matter what. My parents were married over 50 years until my father passed away, and I'll share more about that. But I didn't become an alcoholic because where I grew up or where I, my family or any of that. I became an alcoholic because I like to drink. I like to get drunk. I'm not a social butterfly. More of a triple negative kind of guy. And but I'll crack a smile if you trip and fall down. And I was never outgoing, but I kept to myself. And but my first drunk was at a party where people were twice my age. And this guy said, "Hey Todd, if you want something to drink, just go over there and get in line." And I got in line. And when it came my turn, this guy behind the bar said, "Hey, it's your first time?" And I go, "Yeah." "All right, we're going to do this right." And he grabbed his funnel with the tube on the end of it. And my first drink resulted in beer bonging. And you drink a few of those, you'll feel the effect produced by alcohol, like described in our doctor's opinion. And and I proceeded to get drunk that night. And I couldn't tell you what happened, if I became a peeping Tom or what. But ended up passed out drunk in a garage. And came to the next morning and found out how to get rid of that hangovers by taking a morning drink. And the seed was planted. It was on. I couldn't wait to drink again. I didn't drink every day at that young age. But as I got older, alcohol became more and more part of my life. I picked up other things, trades of the business, I guess you could say, as I found out what a pair of bolt cutters could do. And that's how I was supporting myself at a young age. I became a thief. And I love being a thief because it was flexible hours, work at your own pace. And you get to wear black, you know, work at night. Never had a boss over my shoulder saying, telling me how to do it right. You learn stuff really quickly on the streets like that. And so that's how I was supporting myself. The phenomenal craving always kicked in when I took that first drink. And I never understood that till I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. But, I pretty much drank to get drunk. And, it was pretty common. Kegger parties were almost every street corner on every weekend, you know. And, when I was able to get my driver's license, and get a car from my uncle helped me get a car, and it was a 70 El Camino Chevrolet that was lowered in the front, big wide tires in the back, 454. It was a muscle car, and classic, you know, only a year they made that body style. And the problem is I drink and drive. You know, I had no concept of responsibility. As soon as I had that car, I knew exactly where to go. There was a drive-through dairy that never carded anybody. As long as you gave them money, told them what you want to drink, you got it. And I proceeded to drink and drive all the time. And and I'm one of those guys that hits parked cars. And I never got out, and put a note on your windshield saying, call me. I usually got out with a crowbar and bend the right front fender back and took off. And then I never paid for gas. I learned how to siphon it. And again, these are things you learn how to do that. You don't swallow. And if you know what I mean, and the gasoline, and is what I'm referring to, and but in any case, so I had these bolt cutters, the gas can, and the siphoning hose, and I was getting, obviously I was a professional thief as I got good at this, and learn to, pick up my game and, go after bigger stuff, all that, I was just a street kid, punk, really, but at the time, it was like how I supported myself financially. My father was a cross-country truck driver, so I didn't have a lot of adult supervision. By this time, I wasn't attending school on a regular basis. Most kids my age were like, had a part-time job or going to school, getting ready to graduate, whatever. I was failing dramatically, and because I wouldn't show up, and I would I eventually ended up at a school called Sherry High. These were people just like me. We all had long hair, concert T-shirts, Holy Levi's, and Vans tennis shoes, and we walked around saying "What's up?" or "What's up, dude?" And that was the only words we said. And then after a while, we just gave each other head nods like that, and that's how we communicated. And only education I got from there was how to use a triple beam scale, which is not hard to learn. But in any case, I didn't last very long, and I became a high school dropout. So what's next after that? Well, I couldn't hold a job my life depended on. I'm one of those guys you saw, selling carnations on the street corner. It was just, I got down to 120 pounds. My eyes were sunken in. I wasn't looking healthy. And I remember going to a 7-Eleven, and I didn't have any money, but for some reason, those microwave burritos looked really good. And I'm loaded. I've been drinking, using, you name it, all day long. And I stick the microwave, I stick the burrito in the microwave, thinking the guy behind the counter is not going to hear the bell ring. And the bell rings. I grab the burrito. I stick it down my pants. Well, you gotta get out of there, And I got up to the counter, where the guy was like this the whole time, looking at me at one of those big giant round mirrors I never saw. And he's like, "What's wrong with you?" And by now it's burning a hole in my leg, right? And because it was hot. And I got a tear coming out of my eye, and I'm trying to, all I can think about is I got to run before the cops come. But I grabbed the burrito, and put it back on the countertop, and that was demoralizing. That's feeling like a loser big time. And I had to get out of there before the cops came, and I'm not a fast runner. So it was just one more thing that I was becoming a blow at. The moral of the story is stick to frozen foods. You know, I know there's some meat boosters out there, if you know what I'm talking about. But anyhow, I had to learn the hard way. You know, and again, I'd break into my sister's piggy bank just so I could get $1.29 to get a quarter Miller at the liquor store. You know, now I'm pimping beer at the liquor store, and, you know, like I said, I couldn't hold a job. I wasn't stealing. I just couldn't do anything right. And I got in two major accidents in 1 week. The first accident, I went through an intersection and took half a VW bug completely off. That car, that El Camino, was just a heavy car with a lot of steel, and the guy was okay. And, you know, once I saw he was okay, I took off, and it became a hit and run. And then 3 days later, on a rainy day, I hit a white pickup truck. And again, his truck was still running, my car was still running. So I thought, all right, I'm good, let's go. And I took off. So I had two hit and runs in 1 week. And now I'm driving this car with no right front fender, no hood. I'm definitely in violation. Cops can catch me anytime they want. And I had failures to appear coming in the mail all the time. That's how my family knew where I was, what I was doing. I wasn't showing up to court dates, which turned into warrants. And, it was just on and on. I know what it's like to be so drunk where you got to hold yourself on a chain link fence to hold yourself up. And I couldn't defend myself. And I'm one of those guys that's got stitches all over my body, just getting in scrapes left and right. There was times where I tried to fly straight and do the right thing. I was a busboy at this at the mall. At this restaurant, and my family thought I was doing okay, and they said, "You know what? We're going to go on vacation. We're going to take this, your sisters, and all you have to do is take care of the family dog, right?" And and I thought, "Great, man! You got nothing to worry about, right?" Well, 4 hours go by after they left on their vacation. I'm sitting on the couch, and a beer commercial comes on, and I see Steak and Lowenbrau. What a great combination! Well, they were having a barbecue, a bunch of people. And I'm thinking, you know what, I got the house to myself. There's got to be a barbecue somewhere out there, and because I didn't know how to barbecue, but I knew that was like a great thing to do, you know. And I called up a couple of friends and got a keg, and before I knew it, there was 300 people in my house, you know, and I didn't know any of them, and I let them in, and the only thing I did smart was I stuck our family dog in my parents' room and put a sign on the door, "Do not go in. This dog does not bark, but he bites really well." And if you knew me personally, you would not even challenge that, but because you've been around the family, you've been around the dog. But in any case, I proceeded to get drunk, and somehow in the midst of the night, I thought, you know what, I better let that dog out. But I got a full house full of people, and I didn't know what to do, so I just started telling people, "You need to hide. You know, I'm letting them out. And I don't know who you are, who brought you. You better go hide." And so we started stuffing people in the bedrooms, the bathrooms, the shower, shutting doors. There were 75 people in the garage. That's where the keg was. Shut that door. I think I got a clear pathway through the hallway, through the kitchen, to the backyard. I let the dog out. Sure enough, out of one of the bedrooms, they were cheering this guy on. You know, you can make it. Go for it. And or he got pushed and he started running. I don't know. But, all I know, he made it to the kitchen, and my dog caught wind of him and lockjawed him right between the legs and brought him to the ground, you know. And I don't know if you ever heard a grown man scream, but it's pretty loud. And you know when the dog's got something, right? And because he's just tearing it apart. And and all that did was make the guy scream more and louder. And I'm drunk. I can't get the dog off. It's like one of them tug ropes. It's he's not letting go. And and there's blood everywhere in the kitchen, I got the hose right by the back door, and I put the hose in his mouth, and he let go, and I've got the dog in the backyard, and this guy's in a fetal position in my kitchen floor, and this is what alcohol does to me when I'm drinking. I turn into the Iceman. I don't have very much feelings or compassion, and I looked at this guy straight to his face. I said, "Look, man, you got to go, you're bringing people down. All they're hearing is a grown man screaming here, and I'm like dead, this guy needs medical attention, and I'm not giving it to him, I don't know who brought you, but you better get going." And he did. And, what happens when they have that severe of a dog bite, the animal control comes to your house the next day, and they quarantine the animal, And not only was the house destroyed with burn marks, broken glass, the neighbors were all messed, you know, they were up in a roar because all the beer bottles left in the street gutter, you know, parked in front of their house. And it was just, so not only did I cause this big lawsuit with my family being responsible, but it just made it harder for me to come home. I couldn't look my family in the eye anymore, and I let them down, and I started living in other people's garages. And I started just drinking alone, and I was drinking to oblivion. You know, I could not stop drinking no matter what I did. I couldn't hide it anymore. And I had people die from alcoholism, and I've been to their funerals, and I've seen Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, you know, where all the proceeds go to. And I just never had any respect for my surroundings or how I acted or how I treated people. And I was getting worse. I didn't get better. I got worse. And it's not like you wake up one day and say, oh, boy, let's go to AA. I did not have that feeling. And I did not want to come here. I tried coming here and would not stand up as a newcomer. It wasn't appealing to me. And I wasn't hitting bottom yet. I was almost there, and I was getting hopeless. And there was no friendly face to turn to. There was, you know, my family didn't know what to do with me. One day I asked for help, and I don't know where that willingness came to, but it came in a form of my father had insurance, and he took me to this place in Lakewood and dropped me off. It was called Doctor's Hospital of Lakewood. It's a food court now, but at the time it was for people under 21 to get sober, and I didn't know if I was going to stay there. They stuck me in the room with the funny PJs on. And on the third day, I got my first big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I have this day. And again, I was a high school dropout, so giving me a big book was not like, I didn't get excited, you know. I wasn't going to cuddle up and read it all night. And matter of fact, I wasn't even sure. It looked like a homework assignment to me. And so I didn't get excited when I got a big book. But I did go to my first meeting. It was the Sunset Beach called Thursdays. It's an old bar converted to a meeting hall that the AA community bought a few years back. And the reason I give that place credit, because it's the first time I stood up and said, I'm Todd, I'm an alcoholic. And people didn't care how old I was, where I'd been, what I did. They were just glad to see me. They were happy to see me. And I wasn't used to it. I was always the guy they asked, you need to leave, you know. And people did not, they were like, here's my phone number. And one guy tried to hug me, and I wasn't into the touching game. And I did not know that was unconditional love. I did not recognize that. All I had was street smarts, and I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was going to give me or help me or, you know. And what I found out, Alcoholics Anonymous, there's really nothing to get here. There's only opportunity to give. If you learn that part, you'll stay here a long time. And thank God there was people there that cared more about my sobriety than my feelings. And the next meeting I went to was the Monday Night Bellflower Big Book Group, in which I still go to this day. And the reason I met a guy named Big Todd. Big Todd was 300 pounds, and he ended up being my sponsor my first year of sobriety. And I'll never forget him, because he just stuck his hand out and he welcomed me. And then there was another guy. When I got sober, everyone had nicknames. And there was another guy named Classic Todd, and he was 350 pounds, and he was corn-fed. There was a big boy, and these guys spoon-fed me Alcoholics Anonymous. They took me underneath their wing. The only problem is I was only 120 pounds, you know, so I ended up with little Todd, you know, and unfortunately I'm the only Todd now, and I'm a little bit heavier, but at the time, you know, when you're surrendered and you've thrown in the towel and you just want help, you can call me whatever you want, you know. But I will be forever grateful for these guys for, you know, showing me the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous, the meat and potatoes, you know. And they taught me how to get a commitment. They taught me how to show up. They said, if you drink and use every day, you need to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day. And I didn't have no social events on my calendar, so that was pretty easy to do. And I just got in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and started being on committees and, campouts and conventions and you name it. You know, we were doing something. And it was just, I got in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not saying it's, you know, everything's been peachy ever since, but it was a great foundation that I got. And when I was 2 years sober, my sponsor said, "I've given you everything I can give you. It's time to give it away." And I didn't know what he meant. You know, I kind of did, but it's like, what are you trying to say? I just started wearing a collared shirt, you know, and, you know, because they told me I had to get a job and that kind of stuff. And the only job that would hire me was a repossession company. And there was a lot of people in AA that have had their cars repossessed. And they, the only reason they hired me because I had a driver's license and knew I could still hop fences. And plus I liked it. You know, but people in AA did not, they frowned on that. They're like, "Watch that guy, he's a thief." I'd go to your house for a potluck, you know, keep an eye on that guy. But if you locked your keys in your car after the meeting, "Where's Todd? We need him." You know, and, you know, I'd get a big giant hug. I was a hero, you know. So, yeah, it was very confusing in your, you know, early first 2 years. And but I, you know, I loved going to a meeting every night. Then I couldn't wait to go to work. I'd get excited because, you know, certain cars you like to drive. And certain possessions of what's inside the car is going to be yours. And, you know, it was just, it wasn't a healthy AA sobriety job, I'll tell you that. But the reason I got out of that career, if you want to call it that, is a police officer caught me on the scene. And all he saw was a car thief break into a Mustang and take off. And when he pinned me down and put the lights on and put the light on me, he says, "Freeze." He gets out and says, "Freeze. The cop wants to see your hands," you know, when he says that. And just in case you're wondering. And the car I was in was a stick. I'm trying to put it in neutral, grab the emergency brake. Those kind of hand gestures made it look like I was going for a weapon. And before I knew it, that guy's 9mm was right at my forehead. And that's when I knew it was unhealthy for my sobriety. I had a newfound willingness to ask for help. And Big Todd and Classic Todd got me this job at a rental yard as a forklift mechanic because I was always good at working with my hands. And as the longer I stayed sober, of course, the jobs got better. But those guys, like I said, saved my life in my first couple of years. And when I told you when I was time to give it away, by this time I did a fourth and fifth step. I've worked the steps with a sponsor. And, you know, they just said there was a lot more young people coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you stick your hand out and try to get one of those guys? And I wasn't rushing to help anybody, to tell you the truth, but my sponsor said, I don't want to see you. He was giving me the Al-Anon tough love tactic, you know, don't talk to me till you have a newcomer. And I'm not putting down Al-Anon anyway. Trust me, I love Al-Anon. It was just the sponsor would not talk to me unless I had a newcomer. So I went to the back of the room where the newcomers were at the break, and there was three guys that stood up, and I just cut out the small talk, and I said, "All right, which one of you guys want to stay sober?" And one guy out of three raised his hand. And I looked at him. He wasn't what I was looking for, you know. And he was, you know, different color hair, piercing. I just started wearing a collared shirt. And this guy was wearing, he was wearing shorts, no shoes. That didn't really bother me. None of that really bothered me. It was the twitching. He kept doing this. And I'm like, "What's wrong with you?" And he goes, "I need a sponsor." I couldn't say yes. All I could think about is I need credit. And, you know, my sponsor won't talk to me. And I grabbed him and I said, "Come with me. Let's see if this works." And my sponsor still wouldn't talk to me. You know, and I said, "Do you need a ride home?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I said, "All right, I'll give you a ride home." And that was the start of sponsorship, to tell you the truth. When I started sharing with them after the meeting, and it was one alcoholic sharing to another. It didn't matter about our appearance or where we came from. It was one alcoholic for another. And I asked him, "Do you want to go to a meeting tomorrow night?" And he said, "Yes." And we just started that path of recovery. You know, I've had a guy in my car ever since. And I'm not here to tell anyone how to stay sober or anything like that. But I just know for me, it's saved my life more than once having a guy I sponsor or somebody new in the car. And now I got a large host of guys that I'll explain to you in a little bit. In any case, I took this guy to Barstow for a camp out and watched him burn. And the old timers pulled me off to the side and said, "Look, man, show the guy how to work the steps. You know, there's a reason why I did a fourth and fifth step. It qualifies me to receive one." And ever since, I've kept that in mind and what I'm here and my purpose here. one alcoholic sharing with another, it's kept me in good stead, you know. And then, you know, as you start sponsoring people and going to meetings, and, you know, I got a job at McDonnell Douglas as an aircraft mechanic. All I had to do was pass a screwdriver test and a drug test, and I was hired, 50,000 of us. And we're working on four military projects at the time, and I started working building the C-17 military aircraft tanker. You know, when Boeing took over, I got laid off, and then I got rehired again. So I've been to different areas as an aircraft mechanic, and been laid off a couple of times. But there's nothing like seeing the President of the United States come to your work, or the Defense Secretary come to your work, and feel honor and that you've done something, you know, good for your country. And I'll share more about that as I go along. But, you know, I'm one of those guys, AA boy meets AA girl on AA campus. You can read about it in the 12 and 12. You know, I met a gal that was active sponsoring women, and we got involved. We dated for 3 years, got married, had a son. My son is 34 years old and 10 years sobriety now. But, you know, but I know what it's like to be a father and watch your son go to jail in a courtroom and not be able to do anything about it. You know, and see alcoholism, you know, totally destroy his life, and you know, but to also be, you know, stick around and know that, you know, AA works and it works good, and the life that he lives today is beyond, you know, anything I could imagine. And he's at a Sequoia campout as we speak right now with a bunch of his friends, and I'm just his dad. That's the one thing I've learned. I'm just his father, you know, and I'm not a sponsor or anything like that. And we have a great relationship today, and at the time. You know, when I was 10 years sober, you know, I had the house, I had the wife, I had the great job, and I took it all for granted. You know, I wasn't being a good father, I wasn't being a good husband, and I hit a bottom in sobriety. You know, I didn't mean to, but it happened. And what happened is that relationship, we ended up in a divorce, and I didn't know what it's like to be in a room full of people and know my failures and be able to share those feelings with other people. And it was real hard. I mean, I was having drunk dreams. I was having, like, I was mad at God, AA. All those things came into my life that I didn't really understand at the time. And in hindsight, you know, God's always been there for me. But, it was a real challenging moment. Because, I know I'm not the only guy to ever go through a divorce, you know, but I didn't know how to share about it. And nobody got custody of the meeting. So we still, you know, still saw each other and... I wasn't one of those that got to run off and go somewhere else. I stayed there in my home group, you know, and walked through it. And I didn't want to, but at the time when I hit bottom, I asked Johnny Harris to be my sponsor. He's passed away now. But I've been with this man for a long time. But he told me something that I've never forgotten. You know, he felt a guy with 10 years was just as important with 10 days. And you know what his magic words were? Do what I do. That's all he said to me. He didn't want to hear about my feelings. You want to know what I was doing. He wanted me to show up and be accountable and rededicate myself to Alcoholics Anonymous and be a newcomer with time. That's what he told me. If anything, he's always remembered is me being a newcomer with time. And a lot of people can't do that. It's very humbling. It's very, but my life was on the line. I did not want to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not want to get drunk. And, you know, and I knew I had a lot of wreckage of the present and sobriety that I needed to clean up. And it was not easy. It was not easy. There was times I felt broke and I had to get a second job when I would get laid off. And in between jobs, I remember this happened to me when I left aerospace. I didn't know what I was going to do. And a military advisor for a movie wanted to know if I wanted to be an extra. And I wasn't doing anything, so I had to say yes to any job that was any opportunity, right? And of course, who wouldn't want to do that? All I had to do was be a Secret Service guy in the background of the president that was in a main character movie. What happened is I ended up getting a speaking part, and I'll tell you how that happened. A guy who was a character actor had lines that he was going to give. And he didn't realize the movie was in 1962, where we all had to get haircuts every day so we looked the same throughout the movie. And he said, my agent didn't tell me I had to get a haircut. and he got real adamant about it and says, I'm not doing it. And I've seen the President of the United States come to my work, but I've never seen the power of a director. They're pretty tough. And he came out of his trailer and said, what's wrong? Why won't you get a haircut? And he said, my agent said I didn't have to. And he said, get the hell off my lot. But he didn't say it that nicely. He said it in front of 150 people that he was holding up production and made that guy feel like this tall and said, get the hell out of here. And then he pointed at me, hey, Todd, you'll do a speaking lines. And I just looked at him like, how short you want it? You know, I was almost at a flat top. I was at a flat top by then. So I was like, I was willing, man. You know what I said? All I said was, yes, Mr. President. And obviously I got SAG and got the whole nine yards, residual checks, you name it. But it's no Danny Trejo story, but at the same time, and I love Danny, by the way. I know him very well. But in any case, it was a start, and I never knew I didn't end up going to be an actor or anything like that. It was just, I was honored to be part of something at the time of my sobriety where I was feeling down. And God has a way of carrying you through these challenges in life that happen to all of us, not just me. Like I said, I had to rededicate myself to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started going to Pacific Group. I started, being a coffee maker, set up chairs, you name it. Anything I could be secretary, you name it. I loved Alcoholics Anonymous that much. I would do whatever was asked of me. What happened, my ex-wife ended up getting drunk. And it wasn't anything I did or anything. By this time, I cleaned up my side of the street. I ended up buying my own house. I cleaned up the wreckage that I created. And then I got to watch her get sober again. And I had no part in any of that as well. But I also know we were raising a son together. So I was very much part of her life just from afar. And then by the time she got 15 years sobriety, she asked if I would share at her party. Her sponsor agreed to it, and her best friend shared. So it was just two of us that shared at a party. It was a room this size with a lot of people. And I got up there in front of her family and said, I love her, I care about her, and I'm glad we're raising our son. And, we're doing the right thing, And her mom, I don't know about mother-in-laws for you, but for me, they always disliked me for some reason. But she heard a different Todd. She goes, that's not the same guy you married. And I wasn't. By this time, I've changed. I had a little time under my belt, but I was doing the right thing. I was doing what Alcoholics Anonymous, requests of us. And we know what's true and right and false and what's right and wrong. I came to my own. And what happened is the mother-in-law was very supportive of me, and somehow we were able to go out to have coffee and rekindle our relationship. After 18 years of being divorced, we ended up getting back together. It's not that easy, though. a lot of skeletons in the closet. She loves me dearly, and I love her. And we have a great AA way of life. And I tell that story not to give anybody hope to get back with their ex-wife. I know most of you don't want to. I've been with her for, I've known her over 38 years. The last 15 years we've been together. We bought a house in Laguna Hills. I have two grown big giant dogs. Our son got to live with us for a little while before he went back on his own. We became a family again, and our home is open to AA. We have AA parties, have weddings, you name it. Everything's always something going on in the backyard. My dogs know if you're shady. They check this guy out. My doors are open. I live an AA way of life. I eat, breathe, and sleep Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a way of life. Sometimes her sponsor would come unattended. I'd have to let her in, and I love her dearly, I say that with kindness, to tell you the truth. I love the fact the way we live our life, I'm in the disaster industry. Sometimes I've been to 8 hurricanes and quite a few wildfires down south, as you guys know about. But I normally get sent in right after a hurricane's gone through a territory, and there's usually no water, no gas, no power. And I'm dropped in trying to find a hotel room after law enforcement gets their dibs. And then I try to help people, in time of need. And I always find the local Lano Club when I go to these places, because usually they're still waiting for FEMA to take care of their personal house or their own belongings. But what I loved about this one time, I went to San Marcos in Florida. They were rebuilding the Lano Club. You know, they were putting drywall paint and, you know, took the flooring out. The water went all the way up to the second floor. When I was there with these people chained sober, I just wanted to get a meeting. But they were more concerned about the AA community than their own homes, you know, because, like I said, a lot of people had to wait till the power came back on. And those are the people I want to stay sober with, the workers of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're around here. They're part of this committee. I know they are. I've seen you guys. I've watched you in action. I know what it goes and takes and put this convention on, you know, and I'm a part of a large convention down in my area. And it's just it's an honor. And I'm not bragging about what I do or anything like that. I'm just trying to tell you the best words I can use whenever I see anybody in distress or need comfort. I always say, how can I help? How can I help? Those are the only words I ever use. How can I help? Because that's what I've been taught here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, how can I help and be of service? And I told you about my father passing away. He was a combat veteran, Marine Corps, and the Patriot Guard escorted him to San Joaquin Valley National Cemetery. And I've been riding over 35 years, so it was nice to see the Patriot Guard, you know, being of service. And six months prior to that, my father and I planned a motorcycle trip, and he wanted to ride with his son, and I agreed to it. He lived up in Modesto, and I lived in Orange County, so we met in Barstow, and I said, Dad, let's go to Vegas. I'll take you to the Valley of the Fire and show you all the places around there where I've ridden, you know, and through those mountains and stuff, and I wanted to treat my dad right. I got him, you know, the VI treatment. I got him a hotel room, his own room, you know, took him a steak dinner, and we took photos, along the way on this motorcycle trip, and I didn't think nothing of it. 6 months later, he passes, and it was sudden, and like I said, we had the memorial, the service, and then we went to back to the house, and in the garage were all the photos from that motorcycle trip, even the room key that I got him for his hotel room, and I know what he was doing. He was showing all his friends, hey, this is my son, this is the trip we went on, and I was touched, I was honored, but at the same time, I was thanking Alcoholics Anonymous for that, because I rekindled and redid it, took care of my family and my parents, and I'm still part of my mom's life and supporting her, and that, to me, is Alcoholics Anonymous. Whenever a guy comes and asks me to be their sponsor, I said, go be with your family. Go be with your family. Spend some time with them. They need to know how you're doing. And, irregardless of, you know, our relationship starting out, I want them to rekindle that relationship. You know, anyone can work a program for an hour and a half here. What are you guys doing outside these rooms? That's where we work the program. That's where we take it, take Alcoholics Anonymous. We might be the only example of the big book anyone ever sees. And that's what I've been taught. And, so I've never forgotten that. And I told you, you know, losing the founder of our group and losing an AA member for 43 years, who was an AA brother of mine for 42 years, it's been tough. I've been with the challenge of carrying the group, you know, and actually I'm the acting secretary of the group as we speak. And, so having memorials for people that, you know, that were great AA members and great giants, I've had a lot of support from the old timers. I had to recently get a new sponsor that I'm building a relationship with, and I love AA. It's my life, you know, and I'm not here to, you know, pat myself on the back or anything like that. I'm here to help whoever needs help. I'm one of those guys that'll answer the phone in the middle of the night if you need help, you know, because I know what that feeling's like, and you don't have to challenge me, but you can try, and I will be there for you if you need help. You know, that's one thing I've been taught, you know, when the hand of AA needs to be, I am responsible. Right there. And I love AA, and I want to thank you guys for having me on short notice and not being able to be here all weekend, but it's an honor and a privilege, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you all. Thank you.